President Truman has just announced that Soviet Russia has the atomic bomb. The announcement was made with dramatic suddenness a few minutes ago in Washington.
In 1949, the Cold War rivals turned into atomic rivals.
Total defensive strength must include civil defense preparedness. Because we have incontrovertible evidence that Soviet Russia possesses atomic weapons, this kind of protection becomes sheer necessity.
And the atomic nightmare came to the United States, and so did the civil defense efforts against it.
Oh, listen to me, nightmare, about the atomic bomb. When you hear the story, then I know you're gonna wanna run. You're gonna run, run, run back where you come from. I just heard from a little bird they're gonna drop the atomic bomb. Talk about a flying saucer, streaking through the sky. I'm gonna stop to find out if I'm stopping or going by. I'm gonna run, run, run like a son of a gun. I don't know where I'm going to go, but I'm really going to run. Oh, run, run.
Diddle-dum-dum. There was a turtle by the name of Bert, and the turtle was very alert. When danger threatened him, he never got hurt. He knew just what to do. He ducked and cover, ducked and cover.
He did what we all.
For a few years after 1950, we had the duck and cover policy. An attack would come from manned aircraft with a warning time, or a fair amount of warning time. The weapons, an atomic bomb of kiloton size with a radius of total destruction of a half mile and no residual radiation hazard.
Be sure and remember what Bert the Turtle just did, friends, because every one of us must remember to do the same thing. Duck and cover.
Among the many children who went through duck and cover drills is Dr. Lawrence Whitner, a historian of world anti-nuclear movements.
During my childhood in the New York City public schools, we were supposed to take cover when the teacher told us to do so. And I guess it was a grade school teacher had us jumping under our desks. At that time, the desks were bolted to the floor and had these seats that sort of flipped up.
First, you duck, and then you cover. And very tightly, you cover the back of your neck, your face. Duck and cover underneath a table or desk or anything else close by.
So we'd be doing our math problems, and suddenly she'd say fairly quietly, "Take cover," and we were supposed to leap under our desk at that point. I was fairly tall for my age. I was 6 feet tall by the age of 14. I sort of towered over other students at that point. So I had a great deal of trouble going quickly under the desk. I would always bang my shins or my elbows and so on. So this may, on some level, have made me more anti-nuclear than most, since I associated nuclear drills with physical pain.
Sometimes the bomb might explode without any warning. Then the first thing we would know about it would be the flash. And that means duck and cover fast, wherever you are. There's no time to look around or wait. Be like Bert. When there is a flash, duck and cover, and do it fast. No matter where we live, in the city or the country, we must be ready all the time for the atomic bomb. Duck and cover! Here's Tony going to his Cub Scout meeting. Tony knows the bomb can explode any time of the year, day or night. He is ready for it. Duck and cover! Sundays, holidays, vacation time, we must be ready every day, all the time, to do the right thing if the atomic bomb explodes. Duck and cover!
And cover!
About 1955, the policy became that of the evacuation of target cities. Again, the attack would come from manned aircraft, but because of the completion of our warning detection radar system, our warning time was increased to 4 to 6 hours. However, a new weapon, the megaton-sized hydrogen bomb with complete area of destruction up to 17 to 20 miles, I'm talking about a 20-megaton weapon now, made it necessary to move populations out of target areas to escape blast and thermal radiation effects.
Two, one, T-0. We delay the start of our regularly scheduled program for a special civil defense program. The ABC Radio Network brings you at this time a special civil defense program in connection with Operation Alert, the 3-day test of civil defense. In this program, you will hear reports
Operation
by President
Operation Alert
Dwight
was an annual nationwide mock air raid drill.
Mobilizer Arthur Fleming. For this special program, we take you now to Washington.
The President of the United States has left his last secret location and has come to our improvised studios to report to you on Operation Alert 1955. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, for 2 days, I have been participating in Operation Alert.
Not all Americans took part in Operation Alert, says Dr. Lauren McEnany, an author of Civil Defense Begins at Home.
Office workers, people who happened to be in the downtown areas who could participate in what they called these sidewalk evacuations. In other words, walking out of their building onto the sidewalk and walking away a little bit out of the city. Mainly, it was office workers and military workers and volunteers.
All air stations were directed to go on condition air defense warning lemon juice. Repeat, lemon juice at 1410 Zebra. Over.
Roger.
Lemon juice, simulated attack probable, triggers Operation Alert, plunging America and Canada into a realistic civil defense exercise.
To help people, ordinary Americans, practice the
Savannah,
evacuation
Georgia.
Of our major cities. And the scenario was always that
New
citizens
York City.
Living in the average city would take cover while the civil defense volunteers tested their own readiness. And of course, this was all under the presumption that they could defend themselves against a nuclear bomb falling on a major city.
Olympia, Washington. Target areas have had from 1 hour and 40 minutes to 3 hours and 15 minutes to evacuate or take cover before the final alert.
Region 2, this is the 85th Air Division White. Air defense warning Applejack at 1745 Zebra.
Applejack alert. The nation is ready.
Baltimore, strike. Ground zero. Center downtown.
124 nuclear weapons in all are exploded in Operation Alert.
Oh, listen to me, nightmare, about the atomic bomb. When you hear the story, then I know you're going to want to run. You better run.
When the Eisenhower administration tried to carry out Operation Alert, one problem emerged.
How are we going to educate those people out there? How are we going to present to the American people the facts about possible panic and its prevention?
Panic. Unreasoning action caused by the shock of a strange and threatening experience. But to millions of our citizens, it could have a far more important meaning. Because if our country is ever attacked, mass panic could complicate the problem of recovery.
This concern about mass panic stemmed from Eisenhower's strong interests in the psychological aspects of the Cold War.
How can we educate the people of the United States against the dread psychological weapon of mass panic? Against rumors that can spread like wildfire? The type of psychological warfare that a potential enemy would use. Intruder radio broadcast. To disrupt civil defense, to destroy faith in our leaders. Rumors about our strength to retaliate. Leaflets to advance civil strife. In short, anything to weaken our will to resist.
There will be no great reason for the existence of armies. They'll have undermined our enemies sufficiently before hostilities begin, so that the military organization they possess.
They tried to use Operation Alert to model the appropriate behavior, to model the emotional responses and practical behaviors that they wanted to inspire in the rest of the population if and when the attack came.
But what prevailed in Operation Alert was not mass panic, but failures, confusion, and apathy.
They tried to use Operation Alert to model the appropriate behavior, but every time they tested it, they found equipment failures, they found confusion, they found even the volunteer evacuees, they found confusion among them about what they were supposed to do and where they were supposed to go. And there's even a Newsweek article reported that thousands had evacuated Rockefeller Center in New York City, but that thousands more had ignored the drill completely. So the modeling turned out to not be very effective as on the whole.
Until the threat is gone, and if they drop the atomic bomb, it's going to fall down in the bomb.
During this period, a new danger came to be realized, that of radioactive fallout. It became apparent...
A new danger, radioactive fallout, stimulated another surge of civil defense efforts, said Dr. Kenneth Rose, who wrote a book entitled One Nation Underground.
They did a nuclear test in the Pacific in 1954 called the Bravo test that produced radioactive fallout over a 7,000 square mile area, which astonished people at the time. That alerted people to the idea that fallout shelters might be needed. Civil defense policy previously had been based on evacuation. Obviously, if there's going to be radioactive fallout over such a large area, the need place where people could be protected from it.
A nationwide fallout shelter program began in 1958, but President Eisenhower stayed rather reluctant in this effort.
Eisenhower was very concerned over the national impact of a large fallout shelter program. He worried that it would be a step towards the militarization of American society, or as he put it, the creation of a barrack society. Also, building a fallout shelter system would have been very expensive, $20 to $30 billion in 1950s money. Because of the cost and also because of Eisenhower's concern about encroaching militarism in American society, he believed evacuation idea.
Now, the Kennedy administration started out being very supportive of civil defense. They were promoting a program where people would buy or construct their own fallout shelters in their private homes.
I'm gonna lock myself in a fallout shelter. Get away from you.
Have you ever wondered what it would be like for you and your family to spend 7 days completely isolated from the outside world? You'll meet a family who did just that. Here are Mr. and Mrs. Douglas Brown, Topeka, Kansas, who, with their children, spent a full week in an 8-by-11-foot fallout shelter.
I'm gonna lock my heart to keep out radiation.
Mrs. Brown, how did you manage to cook?
We had canned foods of all kinds, especially the prepared meals like spaghetti and meatballs. But we did find that we should have had more cold meat and cold foods that can be eaten directly from the can rather than having to be heated.
Tell me, what did you do for exercise, Mr. Brown?
Well, for exercise, we had the hand blower that we had to turn, and we found that the children actually delighted in turning the blower themselves. We never at one time had to resort to turning the blower from necessity.
Mrs. Brown, were there any psychological problems among the whole family, including the two of you? How did you get along, by the way?
We got along pretty well, better than we expected, really. The biggest psychological problem, I believe, was the fact that it was not very homey. We did everything we could to make it seem more as a home than as a
Some of the problems with shelters are going to emerge shortly after this. It's going to take a while to identify and mark and stock these public shelters. So in the meantime, the emphasis would be on the private home shelter, people building their own shelters.
Very simply, a fallout shelter could save your life in a nuclear war. This is the reason the Office of Civil and Defense Mobilization strongly urges that every family build a shelter in its home. They've developed reasonable shelter plans to suit nearly every home, every budget.
the idea of self-help really anchors the national civil defense effort, and it anchors the responsibility for preparedness in the family, and it anchors it in the home, which meant that people had to purchase shelters. They had to purchase their survival as private citizens rather than depend on the government.
It's pretty well agreed that the Soviets today are far ahead of the United States in civil defense. It's estimated that
many policymakers remarked that they didn't want to become the Soviet Union in order to fight the Soviet Union. And of course, their perception was that Soviet citizens lived in a highly bureaucratized, highly coercive, highly regulated society. And they said if we create a civil defense system that replicates that by making it compulsory, we have become the society we are ostensibly trying to fight. So they decided to anchor it in this philosophy of self-help, which meant that the government had no responsibility to pay for civil defense protection.
Is now being readied for the public. The goal in the USSR is civil defense training for the entire population, and their program and expenditures certainly reflect this desire. I am sure that the Soviets
they really wanted their civil defense system to model what they thought was best about the American system. Private enterprise, private property, self-help, no dependence on the government, and nuclear family structures. So they hoped that by self-help civil defense, they could model the best of American society to the rest of the world while still making citizens responsible for their own protection in case war came.
Once the Kennedy administration launched a private fallout shelter program, cacophonies swelled in the American society.
See, there was a division between rich and poor. People were asking, would only the well-to-do be able to afford shelters while the poor must perish in a nuclear war?
Mr. Polenz, I know your agency has designed several types of shelters. Are they all approximately the same price?
No, they vary in cost. Some are as low as $100, and others may cost as much as $2,500.
Well, do the more expensive shelters give better protection?
Not necessarily. Some cost more because they're bigger or fancier or harder to build.
There's a division between the suburbs and cities. No matter how much money you had, it'd be impossible for you to build a shelter if you lived in a city center. So a lot of people saw a suburban bias in the shelter program. Mm-hmm. And there's also a conflict between neighbor and neighbor. Mm-hmm. One of the most amazing controversies was what they called the gun thy neighbor controversy, which was, would you be justified in using force against your neighbor if they try to get into your shelter?
Planners worried very deeply about what would happen if some of the racial practices, particularly in the South, but even in the North, in many areas of the North, would have to be sacrificed for national preparedness.
People in Houston, the civil defense organization there is reputedly being used by various groups of people who are using it to instill hatred, to instill fear among various groups of people. When it's attempted to ask the question, will civil defense shelters in the South be segregated shelters?
One of the reasons policymakers turned to private sheltering was not only that it solved the problem of government funding and the problem of government control, but it also allowed policymakers to avoid a national conversation about race and class. If we were a nation that decided to shelter ourselves publicly, we were going to have to confront the issue that many races and many classes were in fact not living together in the suburbs and were going to encounter each other in the public shelters. So the idea of family, the idea of national family, was a white, middle-class, heterosexual nuclear family barricading itself in its own private backyard shelter. And this enabled them to not think about the harder questions.
There must be a God somewhere.
Well, I don't know, but I've been told uranium ore's worth more than gold. I sold my cad, I bought me a Jeep, I got that bug, and I can't sleep.
Uranium,
they tried to encourage people that we could make peace with the bomb. And I mean that very literally, that we could create a peaceful society by embracing the atomic bomb as the basis of our national defense.
Really believed it meant peace in our time, but belief is not as powerful a deterrent as preparedness. Peace in our time means preparedness. The nation prepared for nuclear war is the nation destined to survive.
And that civil defense could make it possible for us to fight the Cold War with the Soviet Union while protecting citizens at the same time. And civil defense was the key to helping American people accept nuclear preparedness as a way of life, a reality of the 1950s.
Well, I took the Geiger and I started to climb right up to the top where I thought I'd find a hunk of rock that'd make it click just like I'd read about burning pits.
On the second but in order to get citizens to embrace that, to sign on to that as a foreign policy, they had to convince citizens that nuclear war was survivable.
Mr. Kahn is saying, objective studies indicate that even though the amount of human tragedy would be greatly increased in the post-war world, the increase would not preclude normal and happy lives for the majority of survivors and their descendants.
And civil defense was premised on that theory that a city could be attacked and most citizens wouldn't die, that a portion of them would, but that a larger portion could survive, maybe be injured, but in the end they could survive such a nuclear attack.
With a Geiger counter in my hand.
Mama going out to take me some government land.
This message of the civil defense was a direct challenge to emerging anti-nuclear movements, said Dr. Wittner.
They felt that it was a means of getting the population ready for nuclear war. At the very least, it would soothe people and make them think that nuclear war was viable, while the strongest card that anti-nuclear groups could play was the notion that there'd be no survivors in a nuclear war and that nuclear war would be suicidal. Therefore, government policies that would convince people that they could survive nuclear war were psychologically very dangerous and politically very dangerous on that basis.
Among concerned people were Dorothy Day and Eamon Hennessy, said Tom Cornell, a freelance writer and chief spokesman of Dorothy Day.
June of 1955, he said to Dorothy, you know, they're going to have a civil defense drill, and everybody's going to have to take shelter or down into the subway tunnels, get off the streets, because they're going to make believe that an atomic bomb has fallen on New York, and this is the way they're going to save it. Dorothy agreed with Ammon that there was an ulterior motive in these tests, that they were meant to prepare the population psychologically for a build-up toward atomic war, for an increased arms race, for more armament spending. Dorothy and Ammon both thought that there was no reason for this and that it was contrary to reason, to the imperatives of our faith, of our Christian faith. As Dorothy was a Christian pacifist, so was Ammon. So when Ammon told Dorothy that he was going to sit in City Hall Park and allow himself to be arrested rather than take shelter, she said, I'll sit next to you. Then he says, you know what, I think I'll go over to 5 Beekman Street and talk to the fellows at the War Resisters League. And so he did. It's not a long walk. He went down there. He knew the fellows there. There was Bayard Rustin, who became in later years Martin King's right-hand man. Jim Peck, Ralph DeGia, H.A. Mustey. H.A. Mustey was the pacifist of the 20th century, the American pacifist of the 20th century. He went and talked to these folks, and they said, that sounds like a great idea. Let's all go and sit with you at City Hall Park. Would that be all right, Ammon? So Edmund and Dorothy said, of course we could all sit together. So they had a few signs, a few posters. There is no security. Pieces are in atomic weapons, things like that. And they sat there, and when the siren sounded, a policeman came and said, you know, you must leave this place and take shelter. And they said, we are going to sit here until we are arrested. We won't cause you any trouble. We're nonviolent. We will cooperate with arrest. But until you arrest us, leave us alone. I happened to be in New York City that day. I didn't know what was going to happen. I had no idea. I got these young fellows together, and we were driving along the Merritt Parkway toward New York when at the Greenwich Station, one of the fellows turned on the radio, and there was a radio report that a couple of dozen pacifists had just been arrested in City Hall Park. Although the protest grew smaller and smaller every year, it picked up steam in the very end, in 1960-61, because the whole peace movement started concentrating on the same issues. The Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy, they were educating on the issues of contamination from fallout. The Fellowship of Reconciliation did its thing, a little more radical. The Catholic Worker and the Committee for Nonviolent Action and the War Resisters League. And at least 1,000 people came out to City Hall Park on that last demonstration. And there were probably another 1,000 people, largely at campuses, around New York City. That was our first major political, or first any kind of political success for the American peace movement in the post-World War II era. So it had great significance, and it came out of just one person saying, Dorothy, I'm not going to go along with this, it's phony, I'm going to sit in City Hall Park and let them arrest me. And Dorothy saying, great idea, Ammon, I'll sit with you.
As Operation Alert was canceled and the Kennedy administration shifted emphasis to a fallout shelter program, SAME took various actions against it, recalled Dr. Sanford Gottlieb, a former director of SAME.
One point we discovered that a critical decision was going to be made about whether to send out a civil defense booklet to every household in America from the Kennedy administration, urging people to build their own civil defense shelters. Ted Sorensen was the one who was going to help push that decision along. And over a single weekend, representative of the Methodist Church's Division of World Peace and myself divided up the country into two telephone chains, and over one weekend, we called people in I don't know how many states, but all across the country, and the message was, send telegrams to Ted Sorensen telling them that if you send out these civil defense booklets, we will organize a campaign sending them back to the White House. Early in the Kennedy administration, I went to see somebody who had a fairly high position in the Pentagon, Adam Yarmolinsky, in a position, I think, close to McNamara. And I brought with me a study from the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy from the Congress. But they had done a study on civil defense in which they showed above a certain level of nuclear attack, and I think it was 10,000 megaton attack, civil defense would be totally in effect, that nobody would survive it. Millions would die. So I came and I told him about this. This was in his office with a very large desk, and he had one book on the desk, just one book. It was Herman Kahn's On Thermonuclear War. And Adam Yarmolinsky turned to an associate of his and commenting on what I had just told him and patting Herman Kahn's book, literally touching it, saying, "That can't be right, can it? Because if that's right, everything that Herman has written was wrong."
Legacy is almost completely negative. Americans showed good sense in resisting spending large sums of money for a massive government shelter system. Quite frankly, I don't think Americans liked the image of themselves burrowing underground to save their own skin.
There are different legacies. One of the things that civil defense did was try to sanitize nuclear war, try to normalize it. American citizens understood atomic weaponry as the basis of our foreign policy, and civil defense aided and abetted the effort to normalize that cache of weapons as the basis of our foreign policy, and that's had long-standing consequences and implications. Another legacy is that civil defense was part of kind of militarization of our daily life. That's what I think is the lasting legacy, the ambient militarism. What I meant by ambient militarism was not formal military rule. Certainly the military doesn't take over civil society. It wasn't that even that policymakers were successful in getting people to build shelters. Most people don't build them. Most people don't attend Operation Alert. Most people don't participate in the whole range of preparedness activities. But what remained, what was successful, was, as I said, this kind of ambient militarism, a kind of ideology of war, a kind of certification that nuclear war was acceptable. And that notion creeped incrementally into civilian society so that nuclear war readiness seems warm. And that's a kind of ambient militarism, a mood and a method about introducing military priorities into everyday life.
Run like a son of a gun. I don't know where I'm going to go, but I'm really going to run. No, run, run, run like a son of a gun. I don't know where I'm going to go, but I'm really going to run.